Okay, welcome back. Our next session will explore privacy, expression, and search engines. Please join me in welcoming Peter Fleischer, Global Privacy Counsel for Google, in conversation with Christine Dobie, telecom reporter for the Globe and Mail.
All right, so here with kind of the elephant in the room, I guess. Maybe not.
I've been working on my weight, but yeah.
Sorry, that was not a weight comment. If you'd like that to be forgotten, consider it forgotten. So I was going to start with a brief overview of the European situation. We've heard a bit about it already. But this basically came out of a landmark 2014 decision from the Court of Justice of the European Union. And the case involved a Spanish man who wanted a newspaper to remove an announcement that the newspaper had published in 1998. And the announcement was related to his failure to pay some debts. So he was unsuccessful in getting the newspaper to take down the content because it was perfectly legal when it was published. Instead, the ruling gave Europeans the right to ask Google and other search engines to remove search results based on the person's name. So as we heard earlier, search engines must now de-index URLs in question if they are deemed inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant, or excessive. So that decision essentially gave Google the responsibility of weighing those factors and the public interest and making a call on whether to remove links from search results. As of today, according to numbers that Google shares publicly, it has received more than 665,000 requests to de-index results related to almost 2.5 million different links. So Peter, I wanted to start with asking you to take us back to that time of the court decision,
yeah,
and how you went about setting up that system to administer that test.
Sure, I mean, I was also the lawyer in the case, and I was absolutely convinced that we were going to win.
Right.
So my first reaction was, ay caramba, we lost. and we realized that we very quickly would have to turn to building some kind of program to do this right to be forgotten thing that had just been created by the court. Granted, it was an interpretation of existing laws, but it was still a new right. And we had absolutely no idea how many people in Europe would turn to us.
Yeah.
We figured it might be hundreds, maybe it's thousands, but we had no idea. We also knew that we would have to be able to handle these in every language spoken in Europe. And we would have to do a lot of research to handle these cases. So the very first thing we did was build a process with web forms where people could submit requests to us. And again, they had to be done in every language in Europe. And people would tell us who they are, what URLs they wanted delisted, why, whether or not they were public figures, in other words, the core elements that we would need to make an assessment. Then, of course, we had to build a team. Mm-hmm. We had to have a group of people who would then look at them. And it's very hard in business, as you can imagine, to try to build a team to handle a process whose number you have no idea what it will be. But we set about that. And originally, we had scores of people. They're in the legal department, mostly younger people in the legal department, who would then analyze these cases as best they could. Now, the original guidelines from the court were very vague. You heard about them at the beginning. They were just these words about information being excessive or relevant or no longer relevant or things like that. You also heard that later the data protection authorities and the Article 29 Working Party came with additional guidelines, but that was many months later. So we were essentially steering in the blind.
And were you expected to do this from day one?
Well, we wanted to get it up as quickly as we could. I mean, we'd been very public that we disagreed with the decision of the European Court of Justice. After all, we were the litigant party on the other side. But we were also equally clear that that was the top court, and there was no appeal after that. So our job, whether win, lose, or draw, and we lost, would be to comply with it. And we set about complying with it quickly. So ultimately, we had, as you have said before, the statistics have shown that the numbers cumulatively across all of Europe were over 650,000 requests relating to 2.5 million URLs. So when I heard the earlier conversations in Canada saying there haven't been any complaints yet, there was a moment where I thought, gosh, I remember that 2.5 million times ago.
And so is any of this automated at this point?
No, we have looked at it. Essentially the court said, hey, you Google, you're the controller, you act like the judge. It's mm-hmm. it's your job to do this balanced test between these fundamental human rights, privacy on the one hand, as we've heard before, the right of people to access information and freedom of expression, on the other hand. We've also heard, as before, in Europe, both of those are explicit fundamental human rights in the European Charter of Fundamental Human Rights. And they said, you, Google, do that balance test. Normally, that's the kind of balance test that's done by courts, yeah, not by private companies. But I think there were a couple things that led the court to order Google to do this. Obviously, we didn't volunteer for this role. We were told to do it. I think first, it was just practical. They think that's probably just going to be too much work for the court system, so we'll have you do it. And second, they said, oh, well, there will be some oversight because some of your decisions can be appealed either to DPAs or to courts. And it's true, some of them are.
And so is there any sense that you might actually automate it? I mean, you're getting this huge volume of requests.
Well, you know, I mean, do you think we could automate judges in our societies? You know, it's a tough call. They're very subjective tests in some cases. You know, I could imagine a scenario where very obvious cases in certain scenarios would be preselected by machines for human review afterwards. Mm-hmm. But think about the problems that we have on the internet with automated reviews of content as well. We're also struggling with trying to find automated tools to fight completely unrelated things like fake news or hate speech or harmful content. Internet companies have struggled for years with trying to build automated tools, for example, to spot pornography. And I won't tell you the kinds of things that a machine sometimes thinks are like pornography but really aren't.
Well, now I want to know. So if you can't automate it, and obviously there are some issues with automation, but what are the compliance costs like?
Yeah. Well, you know, look, it obviously costs us a lot of money. We have a big team. We're spending a lot of time, effort, and all of that on it. But at the end of the day, this is not really a question of money for Google. This is really a question of principle. This is a question of how to find the balance between these big questions of privacy on the one hand and freedom of expression on the other. Now, I would say, as a company, I mean, you know, we are a search engine. Our mission is to help people find the most relevant information that's out there. So any ruling like the European Right to be Forgotten that says, Google, you may not show, you must intentionally omit the most relevant search results, does go to the heart of our mission. But it's not a question about money. It's really principle.
So, but you're Google. Would those compliance costs, in your opinion, be feasible for a smaller search engine that's trying to compete with you?
Be hard.
Okay. Yeah. What's it like working at a company that, you know, you often argue in favor of the freedom of expression, and you're being asked to supervise a system that has to balance this privacy right with freedom of expression?
Yeah, well, you know, look, I am Global Privacy Counsel for Google. My job is privacy, after all. But I view privacy as existing in a context of a lot of other things, and sometimes privacy is in conflict, in tension with other rights, as it is in this case. And I think we heard about that in the earlier sessions, that it's very clearly in conflict. When I hear the discussions about the right to be forgotten and whether Canada should seek an emulation of the European model, a lot of the arguments that I was hearing earlier actually aren't really right to be forgotten points. They were points about defamation or libel or cyberbullying. And there's a bunch of bad stuff on the internet, don't get me wrong, that can hurt people and hurt their online reputations and that people want to have removed. But that's not right to be forgotten. Those are other things. You can say, oh, well, the defamation system that exists in Canada or in Europe is too legalistic and goes to courts and takes too long and is too expensive and therefore it sucks, so let's just find some alternative mechanism and call it the right to be forgotten. And that's a little bit like what we've seen in Europe as well. There are lots of people who are saying, I don't like the defamation legal system, so I'm not going to use it and I'm going to file my defamation case as a right to be forgotten case. But remember, the original case that you were reminding us of here was true journalistic content. That's not defamation, that's not libel. This was a truthful comment, part of the historical record, and that's what the European Court had decided to be removed in the interest of privacy over freedom of expression.
So if, you know, the defamation system is unwieldy, and people do have, say, a legitimate desire to manage their reputations, what would you think is a better approach than a right to be forgotten model?
Yeah, well, the right to be forgotten is just one tool in a much larger toolbox. I mean, after all, think of it as there's this huge world of privacy laws in general, and privacy itself is only one piece. There are all kinds of other things out there. I think one of the mistakes has been people want to hang solutions to other problems on the right to be forgotten for a couple reasons, and I understand them. The first is hey, all the work is going to be done by the search engine. So you don't have to go to a court, you don't have to hire lawyers, you don't have to engage the judicial system. We'll just have a search engine do it. By the way, they'll do it all pretty quickly within a few weeks. And so
and
we'll
you do a really good, pretty good job.
Well, I mean, we are conscientious.
Said.
And you know, and the commissioner cited some of our public statistics that show of the things that are appealed in our decisions, you know, the vast majority of DPAs agree with us on those assessments. I would, however, point out that they're agreeing that we correctly applied the European standards. They're not saying we agree with the European standards or the result. We're just saying you have correctly applied the rules as articulated by the European Court of Justice.
Got it. Sorry, and I kind of got you off track of what's a better solution or a different possible solution.
Yeah, well, you know, well, first of all, remember one of the very odd things about the European decision, we talked about it earlier, but I really want to stress it, is the court came up with a different standard for search than for the original source content. Mm-hmm. In this example, it said the source content is journalistic content, it's protected, it's true, it's legitimate, indisputably, it's there, it has the right to remain there. Nonetheless, we'll apply a different standard to search. So even though the content is still there, it's still out there, it's still at source, it's protected, it's legal, it's lawful, it's true, et cetera, nonetheless, we'll have a different standard for search. It's that different standard that we thought was at the heart of the mistake, if you will. So if you're asking me what would be a better model, there are lots of conceptual models that you could come up with. One of them has been experimented with in Japan, which is where newspapers at source decide that they're not going to leave their archives and all content in all categories online forever. But that's a decision made by the publisher, by the journalist. Search engines would naturally follow whatever the decision is of the original publisher. To me, that makes a lot more sense than having, you know, Google decide which journalistic content comes up or comes down after how much time based on which criteria in a fairly subjective test at the end of the day. I mean, we're conscientious about it, but, you know, it's still subjective.
I mean, presumably in a system like that, somebody could still access the archives of that journalistic organization, and you create a sort of two-tiered system of who can access information and who can't.
Indeed.
Do you think that Google has a journalistic function?
Well, you know, I'm not going to comment it in the Canadian context, because I think we heard about that in the earlier session far more articulately than I could comment it on it. The European Court of Justice decided that we did not under European law. But nonetheless, I think it's pretty obvious, and I'm not speaking as a lawyer, I'm just speaking as a just common sense person, it's pretty obvious that a lot of people are using Google to find journalistic content, and journalists are relying on Google to find their audience. So in that sense, I mean, I don't know what legal label that is in any particular country, but there's clearly a role that Google plays in helping people find journalistic content and helping journalists find their audience.
So there's a fear, and this was raised by the Globe and Mail in submissions on the consultation and on online reputation by the Privacy Commissioner, that companies like Google could lean towards de-indexing mm-hmm. content because it's easier than doing costly analysis.
Yes.
What's your take on that? What's your experience been like with that?
Well, certainly that's not what we're doing at Google. So we are being very conscientious about that. The statistics are that we remove 43% of the requests that come into us that we're analyzing carefully. I would also point out, it's kind of interesting, Bing published their own results about their percentage of delistings, and it's very similar to ours, even though they're making their determinations completely independently of ours. But nonetheless, it's interesting that we all arrived at roughly the same numbers. If I were a small company without the resources, without a big legal department and all of that, I would be sorely tempted to just push the delete button and make the problem go away. Mm. But that's not who we are.
It's interesting, just as an aside, Bing received about 21,000 requests between May 2014 and June 2017, so it's not the same time period as you guys, but that's an order of magnitude less than what you've been receiving. I mean, I think that speaks to the influence that you obviously have, that Google has in the search field. It's the way that a lot of people in the West access the internet. So you have some responsibility in this field, right?
Of course we do.
And how do you kind of see that role?
Yeah. Well, look, I see the role twofold. I mean, first is, you know, the court ordered us in Europe to develop a program and to run it conscientiously, and we are doing that. I think pretty much everybody who's been involved in that agrees with that. I mean, it's like even the DPAs who see appeals in countries across Europe are broadly saying, we think they're doing the right thing. So, you know, we're running the program as we are supposed to run the program. Now, that being said, we didn't really agree with the very premise of the program. And so there's a different responsibility, and I think that's a responsibility to engage in the public debate, to share the experiences from Europe in places like Canada that are debating themselves whether this is an appropriate and useful model for their country, to say, well, here's what we learned in Europe over the last 3+ years. I mean, I know some people think I just came to Toronto to enjoy the spring weather this week, but there really is a part of a sense of responsibility of, well, I've learned something about how this will work in the real world, not just in abstractions, not just in debating, you know, the charter, but like, what did these 2.5 million cases look like? Like, what was it really, as opposed to just hypothetically, what could it be?
Could you give us some examples, kind of on the extremes?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, first categories, and then I'll give you some examples.
Sure.
So there is a big chunk, it's something like 20%, that relate to legitimate mainstream news articles. So people said, oh, that will be a trivial percentage of what you'll see. Not trivial at all. I mean, it's like 20%. Then we see another big chunk, roughly the same magnitude, that relate to basically negative reviews of people online, usually professionals. So that, you know, somebody will, doctor, dentist, lawyer, architect, classical music, pianist, whatever, will get a negative review and will say, hey, I'd like that removed as part of my online reputation management. I'll leave the good stuff, you know, but I'd like the other stuff removed. And we get lots and lots of those. We have a big chunk relating to government records, things that governments by law are obligated to publish. By the way, that was the case in the Costeja original case. Spanish law required that tax audit, tax seizure and public auction to be published in the government records. And we get a lot of requests relating to that. So those are, you know, the big categories. And I think in every one of those categories, I think everybody in the room could see it's pretty obvious. One person has an interest in privacy, but there's this competing interest of others to continue to be able to find the information. So it is very much a multi-party thing, and David mentioned it before. Of course, it's not just two parties, there are actually multiple parties involved in all of this, all of whom have different rights that somehow need to be balanced out.
And so we've heard the example of the Irish politician who objected to being called a homophobe on Reddit. Do you have
it? He was a homophobe.
Right, yeah. That was in his campaign materials, I believe.
I read the campaign material, and you said, give me an example of an easy case?
Yeah. and yet a court decided, at least one court decided in his favor. Do you have an example of a difficult case?
Yeah, we have lots of difficult cases. We have a case in the UK right now, should be decided soon. A person was convicted of accounting fraud. Professional accounting fraud, brought a lawsuit for right to be forgotten removals of newspaper articles that reported on that some years ago. And British courts will now make a decision. Is the right to be forgotten meant to cover something like that or not? You can see that's a perfect example where there's an interest in one person to make that harder to find and an interest in a competing community in finding that information if they want to. We have lots and lots and lots of cases like that in just about any context that you can imagine.
I just want to get back to the training again for a second. Mm-hmm. What does training look like for people who are adjudicating these?
Yeah, well, you know, we as I said, these tend to be entry jobs for young members of our legal department. We have to recruit across all the languages in Europe, so we need a lot of variety on this. We train them on the guidelines. We give them a sort of mentor to go through the process, to sort of look at cases, to become familiar with it. And we have rules for them to follow for sort of easy and hard cases. And when I say easy cases, it's like an obvious yes or an obvious no. And then they quickly can handle the obvious yes and obvious no's. And then for the more difficult ones, the more balanced ones, the gray zone kind of questions, we have an entire process internally for escalation to more experienced and more senior people. And you know, I have the privilege, or at least the intellectual privilege, of sitting in a place where I get to see nothing but the complicated gray zone cases, where you know you think, well, wow, that's really not obvious what the correct answer ought to be. I'm saying that quite honestly. There are lots and lots of cases like that too. It's an interesting job. We also have the ability at Google, and this is you have to speak very practically, to then rotate people through other jobs, doing other things in the legal department. So especially for people earlier in their careers, they tend to like to do one thing for a few months and then do something else for a few months and just build their careers and their experiences as they go along. And this is now one new field that we can offer thanks to the European Court of Justice.
I mean, it does sound like a pretty interesting entry-level job.
If you want to apply, yeah. We're looking, you know, it's a growth industry.
How many, can you estimate, can you give me an estimate of how many people are working on this?
Yeah, we have dozens of people doing this full-time. We have lots more who do this part-time.
Wow. So just getting back to the Canadian context, Privacy Commissioner Therrien, his position is that companies like Google have an obligation to ensure that individuals whose data is processed in Canada is up to date and accurate, and that it's up to those companies like Google to develop develop processes to determine that. What's your take on that?
Well, first, Mr. Therrien is right. That's what Canadian law says. I mean, there's no doubt about that. My response was, yeah, but does that work for search? If you're in the average company, and you have a database of, let's say, your employers or your customers or your employees, like, you know, stuff like that, of course you have an obligation to keep it up to date and accurate. But try to apply that same principle to search. I mean, search, if you want to treat Google as a controller of all of the personal data in the search index, what you are saying is essentially the entire content of the web, right? So you're saying, okay, you search have the obligation of accuracy and up-to-datedness. I live in France, so I forget how to say certain words in English. Up-to-date stuff for, what, a trillion pages on the web? I mean, it's simply not possible, right? It's just not possible from the point of view of the function, the abilities, and the role of a search engine as an indexer and as a company that is providing links to third-party content.
But I think his argument would be that from those elements of the law stems the, you know, he says there's not a specific right to be forgotten in Canadian law, but that you could find it in those elements of the law.
That's what the European Court said too. I mean, there was no specific reference to a right to be forgotten in European data protection law. They were interpreting the European Data Protection Directive of 1995, and they interpreted it from other existing principles.
So again, we kind of come back to, this isn't a perfect solution, and it does put companies like Google in an odd position, balancing freedom of expression and privacy. But there's a need to do something, and the privacy commissioner suggested other solutions, like lowering the ranking of a result, or flagging it as inaccurate or incomplete. What do you think about ideas like that?
Well. One of the critiques of the European decision, and it was alluded to earlier, was saying, well, we'll have the search engines play the role of judge. And that also means, at least in part, we'll have them assess truth or not. So lots of the cases that come to us under the right to be forgotten in Europe are people who say, hey, here's an article that says I'm a swindler. Here's an article that says I did this bad thing or not did this bad thing. Take it down because it's false. And that's all we know. So it's essentially asking us, a search engine, to assess the truth of whether some, you know, dude in Latvia is a swindler in his local community branch bank. I mean, it's really not something that we are able normally to figure out. The court also said, take into account whether the person's a public figure or not. Again, might be very easy if you're a judge in that town in Latvia to know who your public figures are. But, you know, for one of my colleagues who might be sitting in Dublin trying to figure that out, who's a public figure in Latvia, is not such an obvious role. So I'm just pointing out, just practically, you know, trying to live up to these standards is incredibly difficult. Now, when you say, what are the other solutions? What's the problem we're trying to deal with? So if the problem that we're trying to deal with is, should newspaper archives remain online indefinitely at the discretion of newspapers? Okay, is that the question? If that's a question, then, you know, we can talk about whether there should be rules that limit that. But then let's have the journalists engaged, have the journalistic privileges engaged in that decision, rather than just have Google saying, oh, well, that feels a little stale to us, so therefore we'll no longer link to it. If you want to talk about people doing false accusations online, well, then let's talk about defamation law. And maybe defamation law and defamation procedures need to be updated, streamlined, made just quicker, easier to use, and so on, but not bypass them all and use the right to be forgotten. If we're talking about cyberbullying, well, there's an entire different set of arsenals and tools that can be used to fight cyberbullying. But again, it's not meant to be the right to be forgotten. So I guess what I would say is, look, we all know there are problems on the internet. And we know that to some extent those problems are getting worse. They're certainly getting bigger in scale. And there's lots of them, and there's lots of things that need to be done to make it a more civil and truthful place. But I just don't think this instrument, this right to be forgotten thing, is a peg on which we can hang all of these other problems.
A lot of the arguments around this the reputation online debate center on children and youth, mm-hmm. and people making mistakes and having you know, leeway to figure out who they are and then decide that they don't want that out in the world for the rest of time. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there should be a right to be forgotten or something that makes it easier for young people to have information removed?
Well, look, one of the things that the GDPR, people have mentioned the GDPR up till now, it's the big new European privacy law that enters into force in May. One of the things it said is that, you know, if you post something to a social networking platform, you should have the ability to change your mind and take it down. So the example was given earlier about youth publish something when they're teenagers and a few years later they want it to come down. I think we can all relate to that. Sounds perfectly reasonable to me. Seems to me the answer is to have a legal right to demand to have your content taken down again.
Sure, but what if you publish something when you're young and it gets picked up in a news story and then it's published in a news story and it's not, you didn't just publish it on Facebook or Twitter.
Yep, and now we've engaged, you know, the question of journalistic ethics and journalistic privileges, and maybe we'll come back to the question of should some forms of content be removed at source, like a journalistic article, rather than through the tool, the intermediary of a search engine. Remember, search is just one way that people find information. I mean, if the information remains there, if it remains at source, it's still there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an interesting conversation to be had around what we put in stories to begin with, mm-hmm. that we might not have been having 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I also think it's easy when you're speaking with journalists or academics or lawyers to get this, that there's a real tension between freedom of expression and privacy rights. And I know the CJF had some interesting numbers today on whether people support information, accurate information being available versus the right to be forgotten. But anecdotally, when I speak with people outside of that bubble, I find there's a tendency to lean much more easily toward the right to protect people's privacy and reputation. What's your experience been like with that when you talk to people outside of this bubble?
The European Court of Justice said something very interesting in its decision in Costeja. It said there are these two fundamental human rights, privacy on the one hand and freedom of expression on the other. And it said, if you go back and read the opinion, it said, yeah, generally, privacy should trump the other one. It actually said that in the opinion. I forgot if it used the word trump. Maybe that's just on my mind for other reasons. But it said it should be more important or whatever. And I don't think a European Court of Justice had ever picked two fundamental rights and said, this one seems more important than that one. But it did in this context. What people in general think, I don't know. I mean, I read the surveys that you read. I heard the numbers that were quoted earlier today. I have no other insights into that.
So we're obviously having this conversation in Canada. Is this something that you see happening in other parts of the world where Google operates as well?
You know, when the European decision was rendered, very naturally, the very first question that we asked ourselves, I certainly asked myself, is this the beginning of a process where other countries around the world will do the same thing, or other courts will go down the same path? And now we have, you know, 3.5 years of experience, we've seen some things. We've seen one country only in the world adopt the right to be forgotten by legislation. That is Russia, which you'll be pleased to know the law was adopted by the Duma unanimously. The same question that went to the European Court of Justice also went to the Supreme Courts of some other countries, two in Latin America in the last year or two, Colombia and Chile, and one to a US Federal Court of Appeals. And in all three of those cases, those courts, so those top or nearly top courts, ruled that the right to be forgotten was unconstitutional under the constitutions of their countries, simply just not possible, an infringement of their constitutional protections for freedom of expression. So the debate earlier that we heard about, could such a right exist in Canada consistent with the charter rights, is a question that has been answered in a different legal context under different constitutions in those three countries in the negative. I'm not commenting on the Canadian one, but that's pretty much what we've seen. We've certainly not seen again, other than the Russian example, a stream of parliaments racing into this. I also agree with the comments that were made earlier, which is that at the end of the day, whatever a regulator might think or whatever even a parliament might adopt, at the end of the day, since we are talking about these very fundamental rights, I mean, as it was in Europe, a court and the top court will have the last word on it.
Do you receive requests from other countries in the world now that there's awareness of what the right is?
Some. Mm-hmm. So our philosophy is we apply the law. So in Europe, we apply the European right to be forgotten law, obviously. And in other countries, I'll use the US as an example, the right to be forgotten does not exist. And so if we got a right to be forgotten complaint in the US under US law, the answer would be no, that it doesn't exist. So that's the current situation. There's also a big open question, and this is alive and back at the European Court of Justice right now, which is what's the geographic scope of a removal?
Right.
Yeah. So, we're saying it's a European court, European law, so the scope of a removal will be European, but if you're in Canada searching on the same thing that was removed in Europe, you would continue to see it because it's protected under Canadian rights, at least as Canadian law exists today. There is an argument made by one of the data protection authorities in Europe, the French CNIL, that these removals should be global. They ordered Google to do them all globally. We said no, and this issue is now before Europe's top court. I think it's a very big issue, not just for the right to be forgotten, but I mean, the principle is really very clear. I mean, if one country can order Google or any other global company to remove something, not just in the country of their jurisdiction, but worldwide, well, the precedent that would set for freedom of expression is pretty obvious. I mean, if the French CNIL can say, remove this, not just in France, but worldwide today, well, what would a whole bunch of other countries that don't care about freedom of expression say when they want content that they think is illegal or undesirable in their countries removed globally? And if Google were to say yes to the CNIL, what would we say tomorrow to China, Turkey, you pick your example? I mean, I think that's why the principle is incredibly important. It's not there just about the right to be forgotten or privacy. It's really a kind of question about what is the power of any particular state to regulate content on the global stage.
Well, and clearly that's come up in Canada as well, not in terms of the right to be forgotten, but in terms of commercial rights with Equistec. What's your take on that case? It's a bit off topic, but what's your take on that case?
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see, whether courts in third countries, United States is one example, would enforce a ruling that might be rendered by a Canadian court to say remove something globally. And I think the answer is quite obviously no.
As you're dealing with these kind of different geographic standards, in the long run, is it sustainable for Google to have varying standards of privacy for different users in different countries?
Well, that's been the situation for as long as I've been in this business, and I've been doing this dance around different standards and different laws just about as long as Scott and Tess have been ice dancing together. So I wish I could say that the result was as elegant and graceful as theirs. But I think that is the messy reality of the world and continue to be so.
And this is something that you brought up, that your mission is to deliver the most relevant information. I mean, Google already customizes search based on people's, if they're signed in, and I get a lot of Globe and Mail links when I search things. How do you see this as any different?
In one case, the case that you're giving, Google is trying to show the most relevant search results. And we have many different signals that we can look to try to do it. And one of the signals will be for those people, like your example for yourself when you're signed in, the stuff that you've been interested in the past. But we are still trying to show the most relevant search results to you of the lawful content that's out there. That's very different than the right to be forgotten, where we're being explicitly told, don't show the most relevant search results to you, Christine, because of the following reason: this other person didn't want you to be able to find it when you searched on Google. Those are, to my mind, two completely different things.
Well, thanks so much, Peter.
All right, thank you. Yeah.
Our thanks to Peter and Christine for this lively and thought-provoking discussion. We're now on to our closing session, Canada's Privacy Paradigm. We'll hear from award-winning scholar and privacy expert Michael Geist. He's a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. He's in conversation with Susan Krasinski-Robertson, media and marketing reporter for the Globe and Mail.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm here with Professor Geist to talk about sort of how Canada's privacy law needs to cope with a rapidly changing digital age, a rapidly changing society. And where I want to start this discussion, Michael, I know you've said that PIPEDA, our governing digital privacy law in Canada,
right,
is really not fit for purpose anymore. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? Why do you think that?
That's a great place to start. And so it's not just our digital privacy law, it's our privacy law, or at least our private sector privacy law. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'd make that case in a couple of respects. First, I mean, it's been around for a while. It originates out of the Canadian Standards Association process dating back into the 1990s. And we, unusually for a law, adopted the standard as a schedule to the law, unchanged. And so some of the language in the law never really fit in the way that you would typically expect for a law. It was generally negotiated standard, and the government at the time was looking for a framework, and this was seen as a way to get full stakeholder buy-in. But what I think that we have found over the couple of decades that have passed, roughly since this really began, was one, we've identified at times different issues that aren't well addressed by the law. That's anti-spam law, identity theft related issues would be a couple of examples. And now, Digital Privacy Act that included a number of changes, including security breach notification rules that we now know will take effect later this year. So there were a bunch of things that the law didn't do particularly well. But I think even at its heart, there were elements that it never did very well. Part of that's the consent model that I always think that I've long thought hasn't been particularly effective. And part of its enforcement. And so the Privacy Commissioner of Canada here, and unlike most other commissioners, data protection commissioners, privacy commissioners around the world, there's no order-making power, and that's a significant hindrance, I think, to an effective enforcement model, especially when compared to others.
You mean a law envisioned in the 90s did not envision the full scope of what the internet would be?
Go figure.
Shocking.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, and I think you're pointing to a few things that have been raised really recently. So the Standing Committee on Access to Information, Privacy, and Ethics, they released a report just over a month ago dealing with their review of PIPEDA, and they made a lot of the recommendations that you just sort of hinted at, including greater enforcement powers for the Privacy Commissioner, as well as strengthening requirements for consent. There were references to the right to be forgotten, which my colleague just finished discussing. And, you know, they really sort of took up this call that successive privacy commissioners have made over the years to give them teeth, essentially, in their enforcement powers. What do you think about all of that? Did the recommendations go far enough?
Well, I liked a lot of the recommendations, and I should note that I was one of the witnesses that appeared before the committee, so I was glad that they listened to at least some of what I had to say, but this was a committee that I actually thought listened to and heard from a pretty wide-ranging group of stakeholders. I mean, privacy experts and people focused on privacy from across the country. And so it was a really thoughtful study, I think, in that respect, in terms of really trying to bring together many of those views. This issue of reforming the law has been an enormous challenge. I mean, just to highlight just how hard it has been to update the broad PIPEDA. The law includes a mandatory review every 5 years. Mm-hmm. So it took effect essentially in 2001, at least for federally regulated entities. So the first review started in 2006. Mm-hmm. The regulations that will now take effect, we know, in November around security breach come out of those hearings back in 2006. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about more than a decade from when the hearings took place to the point in time when we're actually going to start seeing some change. So the speed with which we've seen this move hasn't been speedy at all, quite frankly. Obviously, it's been incredibly slow. There have been multiple studies on these issues, sometimes with conflicting views. So it's true that lately we've seen privacy commissioners at the federal level argue for order-making power, but in fact, that wasn't always the case. Mm-hmm. In fact, Jennifer Stoddart, when she first appeared, didn't argue for order-making power. She said, I'm comfortable with the quasi-ombudsman plus type approach that we have, but her view and the view of that office changed over time when she saw how tough enforcement was. It's been a difficult issue to get governments to pay much attention to. And of course, we've seen that in the news recently, right now, in fact, of course, with respect to privacy and political parties, mm-hmm. As is certainly a case of governments not necessarily doing what I say and acting in a similar fashion, because yeah. they've consistently exempted themselves as political parties from just about all the privacy obligations we see either in PIPEDA or even some of the amendments that have come forward.
That's interesting. And it's interesting to me too, because you know, when we talk about all those sweeping recommendations, I don't think we can overlook the idea of the right to be forgotten, which has now sort of been officially recommended by that committee. Just to pick up on the former discussion, I know that you have said in the past that the right to be forgotten sort of raises more problems than it solves, right? Because it basically doesn't balance privacy with the right to access to information online. So in your view, I mean, when does the right to de-index information make sense versus when it doesn't?
Yeah, so I have written about and expressed concern about the proposal that the commissioners put forward, partly because I don't think it fits within the law as it's currently structured. And so trying to shoehorn in this right to de-index or right to be forgotten within PIPEDA without really taking a broader look, I think, at PIPEDA with the goal of actual reform, I think, is a mistake. I frankly wish that office was as aggressive about its interpretation of the law in a whole series of other areas, and it's not, and it's interesting that they would be here. Part of my concern, part of it is the balance, and I think that we've had a number of panels that have focused on that, but part of it actually was highlighted by the discussion that we just saw with Peter Fleischer. I got to say, having any company, whether Google or otherwise, sit there talking about reviewing tens of thousands of cases and making judgment calls as to whether or not this is content that is legit, that ought to be accessible through its search engine or not, is just something I'm not comfortable having Google do. I mean, I like Google like a lot of people, and I have qualms about some of the things that Google does, I think, like a lot of people too. But vesting that kind of power in an entity to make those sorts of choices without the kind of more conventional court oversight that I think we're accustomed to in trying to sort through some of these pretty complex, difficult decisions strikes me as a problematic approach. I mean, you saw, I mean, their court system isn't effectively, and we heard it, when the people that we've trained say this is a really tough issue, you can send it to Peter, or to other people that have more training or more experience and can make a really tough judgment call. Peter's super smart, as we saw, but I'm not crazy about him or anyone else in that company making those kinds of decisions. It strikes me it's the wrong place for those decisions to be made, and I think we should be able to say that without being taken to say that we don't acknowledge that there is an issue here and there ought to be mechanisms to try to address it.
And that, to me, overlaps also with issues that we've seen on the news side, too, right? So the head of Google News, Richard Gingras, has told me in conversations that Google doesn't want to be the arbiter of truth when addressing the fake news problem, the hoaxes, the proliferation of hoaxes, the proliferation of conspiracy theories, and Google News's attempts to balance out what is true and what is authentic and reliable sources of information on its platform with not, again, wanting to be the one picking and choosing what is good journalism, what is true. And yet, it's a difficult question because then where does that power belong? Where does that responsibility belong? It's not clear to me that we have a good answer. You say sort of court oversight, but certainly we don't have court systems that are built to have the capacity to be reviewing questions of rights to be delisted or what is true or what is not on the internet necessarily, do we?
Well, I would say first a couple of things. First off, I mean, with respect to the news and so-called fake news and those sorts of issues, I would distinguish between instances where we see platforms manipulated and misused, and the fact that, and instances where those platforms haven't responded effectively to that manipulation. And I think that's part of what we are seeing take place right now with the response. We saw another response, I think, from Facebook a couple of hours ago. Well, I think continue to see those large social media players who I think now recognize that that their platforms have been misused in some in pretty profound ways with enormous impact, and without them necessarily playing an editorial function, there is at a minimum, an obligation for them to step in to ensure that there isn't a misuse of their system. I don't think that's what we're talking about, though, when we're talking about right to be forgotten.
Right.
We're not really talking about people misusing Google. We're talking about people having a discomfort with the accessibility of certain information. In a sense, Google is too good at finding that information, and people often find it, obviously, and a desire to sort of make it disappear. Now, I must admit, I would have thought that in most instances, of course, the right place is the host of the information themselves. What I heard Peter didn't describe it this way, but he mentioned just a moment ago this notion that if the EU courts are right, that in effect Google is a controller for all the information on the web. In a sense, he's describing this sort of super controller where there are these controllers of the information on individual sites, and somehow Google is on top of them. And because of the fact that they have been able to harvest or index that information, they now bear, in effect, the same level of responsibility for accuracy. And I don't see how that can possibly be right. So not just that it's not doable, I just don't see how we can adopt a position whereby collection of data in this context of some of which you don't have control over somehow, but you then are able to disseminate it in a certain fashion through these various algorithms, it suddenly makes you a controller with the level of responsibility akin to the person that's hosting. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Oh, and they are very different issues. My point was only that I think it reflects a sort of an institutional discomfort with the idea of sort of being in charge of those decisions, being in charge of sort of the decisions about things like what is true. And, you know, in the case of the Latvian example, right? So, you know, someone makes a request for de-indexing. How do you determine what requests are legitimate and what are not? And what kind of resources would even be required to do that in a comprehensive way?
Well, so I mean, internet law issues, if we go back to the 90s, started with at least a couple of instances where there was an attempt to lay some responsibility on the intermediary. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of US cases, which I think it resulted in people becoming quickly apparent to people that if we were to layer on that level of responsibility on these intermediaries, and at the time we were thinking more of just of internet service providers, their ability to offer up these services would represent a real challenge, and that we weren't wholly comfortable with putting that kind of responsibility on those players. Now, what that led to was a series of statutes, particularly out of the United States, that have given a fair amount of created safe harbors, in effect, for these players, both for the content and then there's copyright-related safe harbors as well. It's fairly clear we've now entered into another discussion that says, well, perhaps that's gone too far in a different direction, and there may need to be some level of responsibility. And so to simply throw up your hands and say, I'm purely an intermediary with no responsibility for anything that takes place on my system, is a position that isn't resonating, I don't think, as effectively as it once did.
Right.
But I would still say that is a far cry from laying almost all the responsibility on these intermediaries and say, this is hard. Our courts aren't well structured to do this, so you do it. And I think what we know is that, A, that's vesting at a time when we are already concerned, I think many of us are concerned, about the enormous amount of power wielded by companies like Google to effectively adopt solutions that say, our solution is to give you more power, scares me quite a lot. So I think that's a problem. And I think there is an additional problem that These solutions don't scale well. And so Google's clearly got a lot of money and can do this, and presumably Bing can as well. But when you start thinking about effectively content moderation at scale, I think what you begin to realize is that there are not that many companies that can do it. Mm. I was at a conference at Santa Clara University in early February devoted to content moderation at scale. And it was actually the first time that they brought together many of the large players. And so there was Google was there and Facebook and a series of other players who are large in terms of number of users, but not necessarily large.
Right.
So Medium and Reddit and the Wikimedia Foundation. So you had all these different players. And we had, the morning was devoted to a series of panels in which each company basically spent 10 to 15 minutes describing what they do. Google talked about the 10,000 people that they employ doing content moderation, which was more employees than most of the other companies on the panel had altogether. And so what became clear out of this was at least a couple of things. One, the goal of saying you can just automate all of these issues is simply wrong. You can't. We saw that. You see that in discussion with respect to right to be forgotten. You see it on lots of other issues too. Some of the terrible stuff online, the idea that we automated tools can solve all these issues, I don't think is right. I think as well, though, to sort of say that, well, it's you do it. You platform, regardless of who you are, the size you are, you figure this out. It's a cost of doing business. Leads us into a situation where, at a time when we are deeply concerned by the small number of very large players that seem to be dominating our public sphere, what we are doing is crafting a recipe that virtually guarantees that. Hmm. Because many of those smaller players simply don't have the wherewithal or the capabilities to engage in these same kinds of capabilities. And if we adopt a position that says, well, we're okay with that because Google and Facebook and Microsoft are so dominant, then I'm not sure that we've adopted a particularly effective tool anyway, because this stuff will always still be online. And as I say, I think we ultimately consolidate power in a way that leads us to a place, that leads us to, I guess, to the axiom of be careful what you wish for, you just might get it.
Right. That's fascinating. How much of the movements around thinking about Canadian privacy law and how much it needs to be modernized are driven by what's happening in Europe? So the GDPR has been raised here more than once today. I probably don't have to go over what it means for this crowd one more time, but it does introduce a level of stringency on privacy law in the European Union that has raised concerns that Canada may lose its equivalency status. So these agreements that are made between jurisdictions to say, yeah, your privacy law looks basically like my privacy law. I think we're good. And we can have a free flow of commerce and information between our two jurisdictions because we're basically covered. So some have raised the concerns that Canada's equivalency status could be in jeopardy if we don't change things. So my two questions there are, you know, how much urgency has that injected into this process? And do you think that that is a danger, that we could be in danger of losing a very important channel of commerce with other jurisdictions?
Okay. So there's a lot there. Let me start by saying,
that question as much as possible.
No, that's right. I think it's an important one to raise. I mean, you started by saying, to what extent is this, in a sense, driving Canadian privacy rules? And a cynic might say, it's almost the only thing that's driven Canadian privacy legislation, because PIPEDA was closely correlated to precisely those concerns.
Right.
So there was the sense that we needed to ensure that we met the adequacy standard, and so PIPEDA was in effect born. I mean, it wasn't the only reason that we moved forward with it, but it was certainly one of them. We've done sort of piecemeal changes, but it's been pretty much with fits and starts, and on the Privacy Act side, not at all. And so one might argue that despite what might have thought there might have been real movement towards reform and change hasn't resulted in a whole lot of stuff. And we've got a bit. I mean, the anti-spam law and identity theft, as I mentioned, and of course, Digital Privacy Act. So there's been something. So it wouldn't be fair to say there's been no change, but it's been somewhat limited. To the more specific questions, is this creating urgency now and should it create urgency? I don't have any sense that it's creating any sort of urgency right now.
Really? Yeah.
I don't know of a champion in government. To the extent to which getting getting something on a legislative track requires someone to be a true champion around the cabinet table. I'm not aware of a cabinet minister who's spending a lot of time saying privacy is going to be my issue, and I want to ensure that the government moves forward with this, even if only to put it in the window before 2019 to sort of say, hey, this is one of the things that we would do if reelected. I don't think we've really seen that take place in any significant way at all. In fact, if the government thought privacy was a winner that they wanted to at least sort of promote a little bit, then they wouldn't have quietly last week used the order in council to sort of say the data breach rules will take effect in November. And it took one enterprising reporter at iPolitics to identify the fact that this had happened. Otherwise, it took several days before anybody even noticed it.
Yeah.
And so there was no press release. There was no anything from the government about something that we've been waiting for a number of years now. Now, of course, it may be that we will eventually get a press release and we will get the regulations that are supposed to accompany all of this, and there will be some amount of promotion. But given the fact that one of the core arguments that businesses was making is that they needed time to become compliant with this, although they've been aware of this looming obligation for many years, and to know that it's coming, one would have thought there would have been a bit more promotion. So for whatever reason, nobody thought, even at a time when we're dealing with the Facebook privacy issues and the other sorts of privacy issues, that someone might say, hey, government cares about your privacy, look what you're doing. Nobody did it. So I don't sense that there's a whole lot of urgency there. The second part of your question, of course, though, was should there be an urgency to it? And we know that there will be a review by 2022. Now, you know, taking the position that says Canadian law does not meet the adequacy standard would be a pretty big step to take, particularly between Canada and the EU, that, of course, just completed a major trade agreement and all the rest of it. But if the working party is true to the principles of review and they take a look at how far European rules have advanced relative to where we are today, it's pretty tough to make a convincing case to say that our rules are adequate relative to where Europe looks to be once we see all of this unfold and be interpreted and perhaps have some of these other cases come before the courts by the time 2022 rolls around. And if we have learned anything post-PIPEDA enactment, is that the idea that we've got lots of time to fix this is crazy. It's clear that this takes a very long time to process, and perhaps the ETHI report is a good starting point, but I think it's unlikely the government would use that to say, okay, here's the legislation that we're going to come up with. And even if they did, it's a government that's, of course, very focused on consulting and the like, so one would think that we would have yet another consultation on how it interprets or what it takes out of that report. And so I think there is a certain amount of urgency there. There ought to be an urgency there, but I don't know that we've seen it politically. At the end of one of the pieces that I wrote in The Globe, I kind of closed with a flip on the conventional maxim that people often use by saying that good privacy is good for business. Mm-hmm. That's the case that a lot of commissioners and others have tried to make. I think I closed that one by saying that good privacy can be good politics too. I am convinced that that is the case. I really do believe enough people care about this issue that the party that gets up and says that these are the things that we're going to do for privacy and actually stands by it, stands to gain, but we haven't met that party yet.
Hmm. How much does a law as sweeping as what we've seen with GDPR create an urgency to maybe change practices in the absence of similar laws in certain jurisdictions? So we heard Google up here saying, you know, we apply different rules for different jurisdictions. It's a balancing act. We've been doing it for years. But the risk of coming afoul of those laws is pretty significant. So they've said fines are going to be up to 20 million euros or 4% of global revenues, whichever is higher. That's a pretty big penalty. So when a jurisdiction as big and influential as Europe enacts something like that with those kind of threats, are people going to be falling in line in other jurisdictions just to play it safe, or do we really need regulators in every jurisdiction to be falling in line and modernizing privacy laws and making sure that the structures are in place in their geographical areas to make compliance come to pass?
It's an interesting question. I'd start to say by saying from a Canadian perspective, I don't feel my privacy is well protected just because it might be better protected in Paris.
Right.
And so I think we need to take care of our domestic framework. And in fact, this has been Canada for a number of years sort of sought to position itself as a leader from a privacy perspective, not necessarily because PIPEDA was a cutting edge piece of legislation, but rather because I think many took the position that it did a nice job of kind of bridging the European perspective on these issues with the US perspective. And so that Canada might serve as a really effective intermediary between those two. I think we're seen as somewhat less effective now, given that Europe is moving strongly in one direction and we haven't moved all that much. So I don't think the fact that Europe is doing this necessarily absolves Canada of addressing its own domestic rules. Now, will we see companies make dramatic changes based on the EU rules? I suspect for a number we will, mm-hmm. although I would distinguish between companies that say, well, we will try to comply with these sorts of privacy rules on a more globalized basis as compared to how they will respond to other sorts of rules. And many would look at, let's say, right to be forgotten or right to de-index, not as a privacy rule per se, but as a freedom of expression rule, and say, those freedom of expression issues we are going to address differently in different places because we have different mandates in those jurisdictions as well. I suspect there will be other companies that will seek to find ways to isolate their European activities from other activities. In fact, I was one of the people that I follow on Twitter was tweeting out earlier today about an article that they read. I think it was, I didn't get the right publication right, I believe it was in the Hollywood Reporter. And they were noticing the terms and conditions which appear to try to remove themselves from Europe by including terms and conditions that say you agree that you are in the United States when you read these terms. And knowing full well that this may be false, but somehow at least there would be better ways to identify this other than simply putting it in your terms and conditions. But nevertheless, essentially trying to find a way to say, hey, we are compliant with our obligations, and if for people that, to the extent to which we are not, we've made it clear that those people aren't in Europe anyway.
Right.
They've got to be in the United States. So I suspect we'll try, there's a lot of smart lawyers out there, and so some will try to find ways to isolate or position themselves in a way that they think is compliant. But certainly in the past, EU authorities have been pretty aggressive about enforcement, and the cost of getting it wrong is sufficient that many may ultimately acquiesce on some of these rules.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because from almost a philosophical perspective, what we've long imagined the internet to be, this sort of borderless world, is that's really sort of an artificial concept as we see in terms of things like privacy law, right?
Not just privacy law. I mean, I don't think it's ever been border.
Content,
it's
rights,
ever
it, yeah.
It's never truly been borderless.
Yeah.
There was a time when identifying which place you were bordered within was challenging, but even if we were to go back 18, 20 years, companies were still able to get it right more than they were able to get it wrong. I mean, the first big internet jurisdiction case was the Yahoo France case that some of you may be familiar with, a case in which Yahoo France had Nazi memorabilia available on its site and faced a lawsuit in France saying that these materials were unlawful to be displayed in France, and they didn't stop. And Yahoo said, well, you know, we're based in California, and this is lawful in California. And one of the questions that they were asked to address was that the court struggled with was, well, to what extent could you identify users in France? And we're talking about like the year 2000 at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So if ever people would have thought of the internet as borderless, that would have been the time. And the judge in France strikes a three-person expert panel, which actually included Vint Cerf, one of the so-called fathers of the internet and now an evangelist, I believe, with Google. So Cerf is one of the players that takes part in this, and they come to the conclusion that they can identify where people are on the internet with about 70% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which at that time is like still pretty high, but the reason it's actually that low is because there was a single ISP that many in the room will remember, America Online, AOL, that routed all of their traffic, you know, those were the CDs that you used to get all the time in the mail. They routed all of their traffic through Virginia, and so they were very difficult to identify where their users, and they were such a large player that they were a large percentage of that remaining 30%. Mm. The reality is that we knew where people were located way back for a long time. The impetus for accelerating that for content rights purposes or defamation purposes or a range of other reasons why we might want either geogate or identify where people are coming from, those have obviously increased over time. But that notion that it's all borderless anyway, I don't think has been with us for a long time. How we layer on laws on top of this is where some of the challenges come out. And Christine, in the last panel, mentioned the Equistec case, and I mean, and that's a perfect example, I think, of some of the real challenges that arise as part of this. I mean, Google started that case by defending it by saying that the BC courts didn't have jurisdiction over it. That wasn't right and couldn't have possibly have been right. But then the next level issue that was, in a sense, more challenging was, of course, how far could the court order go? Right. Supreme Court of Canada says it can go as far as is needed. We've now had a U.S. court say that conflicts with our freedom of expression laws. Supreme Court of Canada appeared to invite Google to go back to the BC court if they came up with evidence that there was this kind of conflict. Mm-hmm. Google has sought to do exactly that, and now the BC courts are revisiting the order, trying to determine whether or not they ought to make some changes to it. I didn't think the Supreme Court of Canada did a great job of grappling with these questions. Perhaps the European Court will do a better job in the context of the Keneal case that we heard about. But that question, not so much do we know where people are located and can we bring some of those borders onto the internet, that we've had an answer to for a long time. The question of how far should our laws extend in this bordered or borderless or online environment has been the more challenging one that I don't think we still have a good answer to.
Yeah. I want to talk about consent. So one of the sort of cornerstones of the recommendations both that that Effie made here and also of GDPR is meaningful user consent to collection and analysis of data. Yeah. How do you balance out? Some industry representatives have raised the concern that if you make consent a 100% opt-in process, it's going to create a level of friction in the experience of using the internet, using online tools, that is going to be unacceptable to users. That's an easy argument to mock because it is very self-serving, but there is some truth to it. I mean, as a user of digital services, you don't want to be stopped every 2 seconds to, you know, be given a list of things that you do or do not agree to. So how do you balance out meaningful consent? What does meaningful consent look like, do you think? And how do you balance that out with keeping the experience of using the digital ecosystem relatively smooth?
Right. Well, I don't think that's the choice, right? So I don't think the choice is between the fiction that we have today, in which companies claim to have obtained consent, and users receive all sorts of correspondence about how their information is used, all sorts of correspondence from different companies or other organizations, can't figure out how it possibly ended up there and learned that somewhere along the lines there was something buried in some agreement that suggested that I provided consent, either to you or consent to someone else who then transferred this on. And the broadly worded consents that we know nobody bothers to read is, I think, testament to the fact that the current system doesn't work. Now, we could say that it is too difficult to stop everyone at every moment in time to say, do you consent? And if we were to take the view that you've got to keep things accurate, are you going to, you know, as a sort of a spin on, can you hear me now? Do you still agree? Do you still agree? Do you still agree? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is presumably not on either. But, you know, companies are prone to often talk about how they want to develop a relationship with their customers. those are the same companies, of course, that are very happy to take your call, and they'll be with you in just a few minutes. and so we have that so-called relationship, but to me, there is the ability, even within that context, I mean, I'm not a fan of that framing, where there is the ability to obtain, if not to obtain, more meaningful consent, more and better informed consent than we have to date. And I think one of the things that we have learned from the Canadian privacy law over the last number of years is, first, if you establish consent-based models that are so flexible in interpretation that we get systems that you almost need a lawyer to determine whether or not did I actually provide consent or not? You know, the so-called negative option checkbox is buried at the bottom of a page where I don't know whether I'm supposed to check or uncheck the box if I want to have this information used or not. I mean, it's oftentimes, I suspect, deliberately worded in a confusing manner, such that people aren't quite sure what they are agreeing to. I don't think that, which I do think is the status quo in many instances, is acceptable. So then we say, okay, what more do we need? I think we've also learned that companies will push back against more informed consent. We saw it with the debate over the anti-spam legislation, which I recognize raised administrative obligations, but also at its heart was about saying, provide clear opt-in consent. And once you've got that person's consent, you're effectively golden. And we had many that still say that's not on either. I would hope, based on what we see with the push coming out of Europe, based on, I think, a growing realization amongst users that in many instances their information, they may have consented unknowingly or unwittingly to this, and that's not good enough. Given that these are non-negotiated contracts, given that we even had the Supreme Court of Canada in the Duez case last year recognize the imbalance in these agreements in the lack of negotiation, and the need to try to restore some of that balance, if it doesn't come through the freely negotiated negotiation process where the companies give you the ability when you enter into these agreements to self-select what you're comfortable with, which would be an ideal situation, but we just typically don't see that all that much. What we instead is need regulatory models that I think do move the bar up a little bit or advance this a little bit further. And I think we can achieve that without creating the friction that many fear and ultimately leave us with a better relationship, with customers that that see their information is used and are far more comfortable with it because they in a sense expected it, or at least were told, and they had a knowledgeable level of consent in saying, yeah, okay, you can go ahead and use that, and so I'm going to expect to get this correspondence or see information used in this way. One very last quick thing, sorry. From the Facebook issue in Cambridge Analytica, which is of course on everybody's mind, and we learned today that far more people were affected than we previously thought. One of the things that's really striking out of that is the extent to which the problem with the consent model isn't just about whether or not I've got an informed consent with the information I've supplied. It's once you start moving into sort of the Cambridge Analytica Facebook world where my information has been collected, but the avenue with which someone may have gathered it wasn't through me anyway. It was through someone who I friended or built a connection with through social media. Mm-hmm. They've been able to gather it in that fashion. And so that party has it, and there was never even an attempt to develop that kind of consent model. Yeah. And to me, that clearly needs fixing.
What I find really fascinating about the Facebook case is it really illuminates the tension in terms of the entire economic model of the digital ecosystem, essentially. That, to use that old cliche, that if you're using a service that's free, you're the product. Yeah. Most internet-based services, most digital services, have been based for their entire financial health on maximum collection and analysis of user data. And even given that, digital advertising is still super terrible. Like, the promise of it has always been, you know, we're gonna take all of this information about you, but we are gonna deliver to you advertising that is relevant. I don't know that I've ever looked at an ad online and thought, gosh, that's relevant, right? And so we've got this maximum collection, maximum sort of default option, and now we're looking at closing it down. But when these companies have such reams of data on us and they're still not able to make the advertising experience any more tolerable, what does that tell us about the tension that's going to exist in those companies as they are, I think, in a lot of ways, legitimately trying for business reasons to make that advertising better? They have a real financial argument for continuing to collect as much information and analyze it as much as possible. that is going to fight with this sort of newfound scrutiny over things like what you just raised with the Facebook issue. So what's the balance there? And is it even possible to strike a balance when really the economics of the internet is based on data?
Right. You're obviously far more of a marketing expert than I am. I guess I'm not wholly convinced that digital advertising is quite so bad. It's certainly creepy sometimes. And so it's the creep factor that I think becomes a problem with the data collection, right? It's those times when you kind of just, you know why you're seeing the ad that you're seeing, and you know that it has to do with some sort of data collection and this attempt to try to bridge something together, and it feels a little icky. And I think in those circumstances, I think it is quite ineffective. I think also in the last day or two, maybe it's just been today, there was one report that says that Facebook has an internal study that the Trump campaign utilized Facebook and Facebook advertising far more effectively than the Clinton campaign. Mm-hmm. Given some of the credit that is being given to that social media and the like, part of it was, of course, ad-driven. Seems to me that might be an example where it was actually fairly effective. He's president. And so it clearly had some level of impact. I would suspect that the very best of the digital ads are the ones where you think, wow, there's nothing really effective here. I haven't noticed anything, but that's probably, that may be what has made it effective. So it hasn't sort of bleached into the icky side where it's just so obvious that someone's following you, but it's also not so irrelevant that you're thinking, why on earth am I seeing this? It kind of just blends in and becomes part of what you're seeing. And that's probably more effective than, or might well be viewed as more effective than some of the other advertising that we see where, the old saw that it's effective 50% of the time, you just don't know which 50%.
Right. Right, but I mean, I think the larger point, though, is that the collection of data, there are real financial reasons why these companies want to collect a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me that, when you talk about that old, the thing that everyone says that, good privacy is good for business, well, there might be an argument to be made by some of those companies that, we definitely want to respect privacy, but also we need this data, we need this information. Mm-hmm. And so the balancing act between some of those commercial concerns and the legislative concerns, I think, might be an interesting discussion.
It might. One of the real interesting challenges that we have is the extent to which people are willing to pay for privacy. And we haven't seen a lot of good examples yet of a willingness to do so. There have been over the years, a number of startups that place their bet on people's willingness to pay, anonymous browsing, or other kinds of things. And we don't see a lot of willingness to pay there. There is a willingness to pay for VPNs. Clearly, mm-hmm. Virtual private networks have proven very popular. So to the extent to which people are using VPNs for privacy-related purposes, that's one instance where people are willing to pay for it, but I think we would recognize that VPNs are useful for a myriad of purposes, and privacy is but one of them. So people may be buying that, of course, for other sorts of reasons. There have been a number of people that have argued that they would be very happy to pay for Facebook if only Facebook would allow them to do so. And so give me an ad-free, Snoop-free experience, just let me connect with my friends, charge me a subscription fee, and that's something I'll pay for. Facebook clearly, for the moment, sees a better business model in their current business model. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be a very interesting experiment, and Facebook might ultimately be surprised at the extent to which, especially as people learn more and more about this, that what they really want is a good way to connect. Facebook seems indispensable, at least to some, although my kids tell me this dates me and that it is not indispensable to them, that the people want to use it and that there might well be a willingness to pay. But we haven't seen enough experimentation, I don't think yet, with that kind of model.
Just briefly before we go, I want to ask you one more question. You mentioned the security breach notifications. We finally heard about when that's going to come into force. And that's taken a number of years. Do you think that legislators are moving fast enough in terms of keeping up with the changing privacy concerns, the changing dynamics of the digital sphere?
Wow, I mean, that's a softball.
you are welcome. That.
There we go. So it's just, I mean, clearly no. I will say that there is the extent to which there are committees that are studying these kinds of issues far more, and that there are politicians who are far more interested in these issues, that dynamic has changed. So getting a lot of invitations to appear before committees, a lot of other people focused on this stuff are as well, and I'm glad that politicians are focused on it. The dynamic, at least as I see it right now in Ottawa, or experiencing in Ottawa, is that there is still a bit of a disconnect between committees that are quite happy to study it, governments that are happy to consult on it, and the actual step that people are actually participating in all of these things, which is to actually see some real change. And that isn't happening in any significant or meaningful way. So we've had lots of studies, we've had lots of consultation, we will get more studies and more consultation, but on this issue, I suspect, and others, but what we need now, I think, in the view of a lot of people, is we actually need action. And whether that's on these privacy issues or on a number of other digital-related issues that there is a recognition are just critically important to our societies, to our economic futures, to our ability to keep pace, are really essential, and we just don't see it. I mean, for me, just to give a quick example, very quick apparently, we had a government that spent a year talking about an innovation agenda and put in tons of money into the innovation and sort of highlighted a whole series of different things associated with it. But the part that we ultimately trust government to do, which is not just to spend our tax dollars, but to actually create sort of the legal and regulatory frameworks that will help support all of this, is almost entirely missing. Hmm. And so in many ways, I mean, job one for a government that talks about innovation would have been to ensure that our frameworks, our regulatory and legislative frameworks, which doesn't necessarily cost anything, would actually be pro-innovative and help move us forward in this area. And yet it seems it's easier to cut checks and make spending announcements than it is to actually do the engage in the much tougher legislative process side.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for joining us. That's great.
Thank you. Another round of appreciation for Michael and Susan, and to all of our speakers. We've been treated to a superb half day of discussion. On behalf of the CJF and CIPIC, I'd like to thank all of our speakers and our moderators for making this a timely and robust debate on striking the balance between privacy and freedom of expression and information. The CJF is producing a white paper offering up a summary of the insights and arguments of today's program, and we look forward to sharing that with all of our attendees. We hope you'll stay with us and join us to continue this conversation at the cocktail reception in the next room. Thank you.